Life Audio.
This is Empowering Homeschool Conversations.
We want families to come here and gain insightful strategies that empower them to successfully teach diverse learners at home.
Hosted by founder and CEO of Sped Homeschool, Peggy Ployer.
Our goal is that these powerful weekly conversations will boost your confidence to cultivate the best at-home learning environment for your student.
For more homeschool resources, go to spedhomeschool.com. You're listening to Empowering Homeschool Conversations with Peggy Ployer. We'll start the conversation with Peggy and her guests next.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
This is Empowering Homeschool Conversations, provided by Sped Homeschool, a nonprofit that empowers families to home educate diverse learners. To learn more, visit spedhomeschool.com. Here's Peggy Ployer.
So today we are going to talk about student stress management and some strategies on how to overcome that, or at least help your student to manage it better. And my guest is Dr. Kelly Fernell, PhD, the founder in-house Test Prep. Welcome, Kelly, and thank you for joining us.
Hi, thanks so much for having me on.
Yes, absolutely. I'm excited for this conversation. We're kicking off a new month and a new topic. We're going to be talking about twice exceptional learners. And I don't know if you maybe know what that is, audience. It's that gifted child with that extra glitch and or some glitches in some areas. And so oftentimes stress is something that these students deal with a lot because some things come easy and some things are really difficult. And so I'm excited, Kelly, for you to share some of your expertise in this area. And I know you've worked with a lot of students who kind of have this label and have a lot of wisdom to share with us. So we've got some viewers popping on, I see already, and Kirisu is already saying hi on YouTube. So welcome, everybody. Just know that if you're watching live, just put your comments, your questions in the feed. We would love to include you in this conversation. That's why we go live. And to just ask us questions that you think would be applicable to this conversation, and we'll happily include them. So, Kelly, as we are getting started, I would love for our audience to get to know you and a little bit about your background. And so if you can just tell us a little bit about why you're passionate about helping students, what in-house Test Prep is, and then also just maybe just how you got involved in this field. And it's kind of always exciting to hear people's stories. And so let's start out with that.
Yeah, sure. So I do own a test prep business, and I primarily help students get ready for tests like the SAT or the ACT. I also help students who are looking at entrance exams for private schools and boarding schools as well. And then I also do math tutoring as well. And so I kind of do both of those.
Yeah. Areas.
And the way that I got into test prep was actually when I applied for grad school. When I was a senior in college, I had to take the GRE, which is like the SAT for graduate school. And I learned 1,040 vocabulary words for this test.
It's wow.
Vocabulary. And after I was done with it, took the test, and I thought, I should really do something with those 1,040 words that I just learned. And test prep seemed like a natural extension of that. And I got hired by Princeton Review, which is one of the major test prep companies, as a senior in college. Learn how to teach the SAT from them. And at the time, the SAT and the GRE were pretty similar to each other. Went off to grad school. I was originally studying psychology, ended up switching to public health. But when I finished my degree, I actually ended up starting a test prep business because I really loved doing it and I enjoyed
it. Awesome.
And I started my business. I've been teaching test prep since 2001, and I started my business in 2007 and had been all local, had an in-person business. And then right before the pandemic, I decided I wanted to take my business online.
Wasn't that a good move?
I was about 3 months before the pandemic. I got a Zoom account in January of 2020.
And nobody knew what it was.
I had this grand 3 to 5 year plan to get myself out of my office and online, and it took 3 months of the pandemic.
Right.
That was that. And I never went back to my office, and it's turned out to be really amazing because it now means I can work with students anywhere. I have students in New York.
Absolutely.
I have students in California. I have one in London. I had one in Spain, and it really means I can just reach kids everywhere, which I love.
Yeah. What a rewarding work that you can do. Just help them to achieve those goals that I'm sure that they're just striving for. And sometimes they feel like, you know, it's, I don't even know if I can do it. And I guess that's a lot of what stress and that anxiety has to do with students of all ages.
Exactly.
Is they hit those roadblocks. And I know as a parent who has a child like that, it seems overwhelming to us on how to get them to move on past those obstacles, because we ourselves sometimes haven't got past them ourselves. And so I'm excited for, you know, your ability to speak into this this topic and to share some strategies with us, because our parents, they definitely need it. And I always learn something new too. But can we talk just a little bit about learning stress, maybe some of the background on that, what causes it, and also what may accentuate those learning stresses?
Sure. And when we're talking about stress and anxiety, one of the things that's always important to me to talk about at the beginning is the difference between pretty normal and typical levels of stress and
yes,
and levels that actually are harmful in some way, or that are hurting children or hurting adults too. But some level of stress and anxiety is a natural, normal part of life. It's what helps us survive. And a lot of times in intro psychology classes, you always hear the example of in the old days, if a tiger was running at you, you're going to experience a burst of stress and anxiety and hormones, and as you should. There's a tiger running after you, or a lion, or whatever is chasing you. And that is natural, that's healthy, that's normal, and that's a survival instinct. It's a mechanism for your body to say, hey, there's danger, we need to get out of here. Some mobilize and do it. So that's normal. And we don't have tigers anymore, hopefully most of us that are missing. But we've got deadlines, and we've got driver's ed exams, and maybe we have standardized tests and schoolwork and friends and navigating the world, a pandemic. There's a lot of things to have stress and anxiety about it. So some level of that is normal, and it is adaptive, and it's healthy and just fine. But there are certain points where that anxiety and stress really start to become kind of pathological in a way, and it is harmful for children to experience those levels. And some of the ways that you know the difference is really the intensity and also the amount of distress that it's causing. So if your child is anxious before a soccer game, and they're anxious for the 10 minutes before it, and they're nervous and have jitters, but as soon as they start playing, it's fine, no problem. That's normal. Okay. But if they're starting to just dread, if they're so anxious about that soccer game that they're like, I don't want to go, I don't feel well, I just want to stay home, I want to quit, I don't want to do it, and they're not able to function in a way that they would like to be able to function, that's when it starts to become a problem, when it's interfering with somebody's ability to live their life in the manner that they want to. That's a red flag of, hey, we probably need to intervene somewhere.
Exactly. Here. Yes. Yeah. That makes so much sense. Cause yeah, we have to have some sort of that anxiety. It's almost what gets us ready for that fight.
Exactly.
What's ever ahead. And if we don't have it, we don't go in as prepared, I think. And so, so that's a good point to make, is that there are various levels and we have to be cognizant of what is typical for our child and what they can push through.
Exactly.
And I've even heard with learning too, is that you don't want it to be too easy, because then it doesn't challenge the child enough. And there's some sort of reward, internal reward, of overcoming a challenge instead of just everything always being easy too.
Exactly. And something that I see a lot with my students, I do work with a lot of students who have learning differences, ADHD, dyslexia, autism, math learning disabilities. And I see within those students, it does cause a lot of stress. And there are a couple of reasons for that. And one of the big reasons is, one, the kids are frustrated because these things come, they're hard for them. And they might have brothers and sisters who those things do not come.
Oh, yeah.
It's not hard for them, or it comes naturally, or they're very gifted in an area that the my other student one is, may not be.
Right.
And within the context of my testing business, a lot of times I'll have students come to me and they'll say, well, what's wrong with me? And why can't I get this score? They're like, my brother just walked in and got almost a perfect score on the SAT or the ACT without studying. And here I am at a very mid-level score. And what's wrong with me? Why am I dumb? Why am I stupid? And I really have to talk with them about, there's nothing wrong with you. You're not dumb or stupid. You have a challenge that's different from challenges that other people have. But it's true for everybody. We all have something that is hard and challenging for us.
Exactly. And after a word from our sponsor, we'll dive back into this conversation.
This is Empowering Homeschool Conversations, provided by Sped Homeschool. Go to spedhomeschool.com to get resources and support for teaching your unique learner at home.
It has taken me a long time, both as an educator and just personally, because I'm so indoctrinated into our culture, as we all are, to realize that the emphasis on being good at math or being good at science or being good at writing versus being good at art or music or sports or something, that's a social construct. We have just made up that it's more valuable to be good at math. Than to be good at art. And I was a very highly motivated student. I was very grade motivated and success motivated, score motivated. And I really bought into that belief too. And a couple of years ago, I realized I'm terrible at art. I can draw at about a 5-year-old level, and I'm not kidding. It's pretty much like disability level art. But nobody has ever said to me, hey, there's something wrong with you because you draw like a child. And I do, and there's nothing wrong with drawing like a child, but as an adult, I feel like I should be able to draw better than a 5-year-old, but it's not my talent and it's not my skill. And I'm lucky that nobody's ever said to me, hey, there's something wrong with you, or we need to intervene, or we need to fix you.
Right.
Because my thing I'm bad at happens to be on the list of things we, as a society, just don't care as much about.
Optional or a hobby. Yes.
Right. And it has taken me a long time to realize that, no, I'm not a better person or more valuable because I am good at math. And it's taken me a long time. I had to go back and relearn a lot of it versus my kids who, I have kids who do amazing things. I mean, they're amazing in art. They've started businesses. They've written songs. They write movies, shoot movies. And I mean, it's just amazing. So when I have students who come to me with that really negative self talk and self-doubt, I do really talk with them about, okay, here's what it means and here's what it doesn't mean. And really, it doesn't mean anything. It just means, okay, you struggle with this thing, so what? And there are ways you can intervene, there's ways you can help, but it really doesn't say anything about a student as a person. And I think really haven't gotten that message before. And I have a lot of students who come from very successful families, and so they see their parents have succeeded, their brothers and sisters have succeeded, and a lot of times they feel like they're letting their families down. They're like, well, my mom is expecting me to have a laser, to get this on this test, or be able to perform in this manner. And when they can't, or they don't have the skills to do it, that can lead to a lot of anxiety as well. And often parents don't even know that their children think that, because they might feel like, oh, they're being accepting and welcoming and embracing the child as they are, but sometimes those messages are, sometimes they're overt, but a lot of times they're just very subtle.
Yeah. It's that self-talk that we don't often, well, we don't hear it. We don't think about it. When kids are younger, they tend to like verbalize that, but you know, as you're working with more towards the teens, that's all enclosed inside. It's been things that the society has fed them, where we as parents have tried maybe to not say those things, but yet there's other influences coming in, and we have to combat those. And and like you said, you know, let them know that there is thing, there are things that they can do. And I teach students, and they see me, you know, after I've done something for 5 years, you know, I can do it perfect. And so one of them just started crying when I was teaching her because she couldn't get it right away. And I said, wait, stop, sit down. I want to show you something I'm working on right now. And when she saw me struggle, then it was like, oh, it's okay that I struggle too, you know? And so just helping students to understand everybody hits a point where they no longer are good.
Yes.
And so, yeah, that stops the self-talk is because it is just that perpetual lie that, that makes that stress even worse. So, yeah.
Yeah. And I talk a lot with my kids about stopping that negative talk. And also I won't let them engage in it either. If they'll try something, I'll go, oh, I'm so stupid. I'll say, you're not stupid. You you weren't paying attention on that one, or you haven't learned this skill, or you were distracted, or you got tricked by a question that's designed to be tricky.
And right. Yeah. Those are great comebacks.
That doesn't mean you're
definitely
dumb.
Yeah.
It means other things. You're fine. So I always try to head that off at the pass when I hear it. And I really try to encourage them as well, because our brains and our bodies are listening to us. And if you're constantly saying in your head, I'm dumb, I'm stupid, I can't do this, it is going to cause a lot of stress. It is going to cause anxiety. And it makes it hard to learn when you're constantly hearing, oh, I'm stupid and I can't do it. Even if it's coming from yourself, that chatter can be incessant. So that's one of the things I talk a lot with my kids about and try to help them with, is really just even identifying that chatter in the first place, because it's so automatic for most people that most students and most adults too just aren't even aware that that is going on. And that's one of the first steps of dealing with anxiety, is being able to identify some of those things, once you identify them, then you can work on changing them. But if you're not even aware of them, nothing's going to happen. And once they start listening for it, they're like, oh, actually I'm saying that to myself 6 times an hour, or, you know, every 5 minutes or something. And it really takes a toll on kids.
It does. Yeah. Yeah. You have to replace that lie with truth. And, you know, it does take being proactive, because you've trained your mind. It's like you've created this rut of thinking, and now you got to pull out of that and then put in that new mantra, or, you know, whatever, and say that over and over again until you start saying that instead. And so a lot of times we think in correcting a child just one time, it's going to work.
Yes.
But it does take a long time to get them to think that way. So that's, that is definitely a great, great thing to talk about is that as well. And then, you know, just the areas where students aren't as skilled. How do you work, you know, with a student, especially when they're in that struggling, you know, subject and that stress that comes with that? Do you have any strategies for that?
So with my kids who are having issues like that, which is honestly most of them, some of it is a balance of figuring out what strengths are, what weaknesses are, and then really balancing those two things, because sometimes there are things that just aren't going to be fixed. Sometimes kids with particularly severe dyslexia or some of the other issues, they may not be totally, and I say this in quotes, quote, totally fixable, but there are ways to maneuver around them so that kids can do things in ways that they can be successful. So like in the context of my testing that I teach, sometimes the reading comprehension passages, which are the long stories with questions, there are certain types of questions that some of my students are just never going to be able to answer. And so what we do is say, okay, we know this question is probably not answerable for you. So sometimes like with there's questions where they ask you to infer things where they don't come right out and tell you. And some students, especially sometimes students who are on the spectrum,
exactly,
that's a skill they just don't have. And no amount of working or practicing or prepping is going to change that. And it doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the kid. It just means that skill isn't there. Okay.
Right. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Fine. And so if we know you're never going to get these ones, great. Okay. Now let's go spend our time on the things that you are likely to get right. And sometimes people have a little bit of instinctive pushback about that, about no, everybody can do everything. And honestly, it's not true. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. And so if you can figure out how to work around your areas of weakness and improve them in the ways that you can, but also recognize at a certain point, there are some things you just may never be able to do. Okay. So go do the things that you can do and strengthen those. And so a lot of what I do with my kids is figuring out, all right, this question is probably not in your wheelhouse, but hey, look, you're really good at these questions. We're going to spend the time on these ones because these are the things you know how to do. You're likely to get right. It's within your ability to learn them. No problem. And that's sometimes nobody's ever said that to these kids either. That it's okay to just know, okay, there may be some things that aren't for you and not everything is for everybody. And you do have to be careful with that. There's a fine line of
the child will say, I'm not good at anything.
I don't have to do it. I don't have to try, you know, I don't need to make the effort. So there is a very fine balance there, but it is really true that there are limits to all of our abilities. And if you bump up against a limit and you've hit it, don't keep trying to go past it. It'll make you crazy. And there's no reason to do it. Mm-hmm. And so,
which is something that we embrace greatly in the business world. You know, you function in your area of giftedness and you hire team members or you work with team members who, you know, have those opposite skills and you learn to work together and you appreciate each other's gifts. Mm-hmm. And that makes everybody better. And instead of one person trying to do the whole job themselves, it just, it doesn't work. And
to be functional, to have the skills that they need. But, and I was thinking about this last night with students, I want them for math. I want them to know how to do fractions and decimals and percents and know their times tables and be able to solve a basic algebra question, because those are skills that a lot of you do actually need in adult life. I use those skills all the time for when I'm shopping or when I'm trying to measure something or I'm trying to put something together. Those are basic life function skills. I want my students to know them, but not everybody does need to know advanced algebra. And if that's not your thing, okay.
Yeah.
You know, have the skills you need to function, because that's part of what school is helping you be a functional human. Can you function in your adult life? Are you ready to go do the things you need? And there's a lot of paths that people can follow. They can homeschool, they can go to school, they can go to university, they can go on a gap year, they can go to trade school, all kinds of things. And I think there's lots of paths for lots of different people.
Yeah, so true. And going in with that mindset, you know, really we've been talking about a mindset as to, you know, what is doable. Mm-hmm. And I mean, like I was thinking as you were talking, you know, to understand a process is different than mastering a process. Mm-hmm. And so it is good to know, to understand the basics of why this thing works, or, you know, even like those long comprehensive questions, you know, and inferences, why do people use them? But mastering them and spending a lot of time when that is not in the, you know, the top qualities of your wheelhouse, it's okay. But at least you know why people do it. And for those people that do it well, why it's important to lean on people that have that skill. And so it's just bringing greater awareness. But yet at the same time saying, you know, that's just something I can step away from, be comfortable about, and be happy that other people do it.
Yes. And at the same time, knowing it's okay to do hard things, you can do hard things, because I do want to make sure my students aren't coming away going, oh, well, I can't do it. So fine.
Right.
And because there are things that that are hard for people and that are worth spending time and energy to do. So
absolutely.
It is a little balance in there.
Yeah. Yeah. We were just talking about math, and I know one of our viewers talked about math curriculum that she said, I've heard there's math curriculums that use art to teach math concepts. Do you know of one? I don't know if you know of any math.
I don't offhand. Okay. Unfortunately, yeah. Sorry.
I know one geometry program that uses paper folding, which is a very hands-on. So kind of that's like more like origami, but it's called the patty paper geometry. So maybe that'll help you. I don't know. But that was one way I was like, finally, geometry made sense to me. I have a degree in physics and I'm very good at math, but geometry, I failed it in college.
Geometry, I had trouble with too, honestly. And now I teach it. And that's what I tell my kids all the time too. You never know when you say, well, why do I need to learn this? I'm never going to use it. And then I tell them the story about me because I knew I wanted to be a psychologist from grade 9 on. And I spent 8 years in 9th through high school and then all through college preparing to get into grad school in psychology. I got into grad school in psychology. I went, and on the second day of class, I remember clearly sitting there and thinking, this was the wrong decision. This is not the right place or the right time. And because I had worked so hard and didn't know I could change my mind, I was 22 and had just always learned if you decide to start something, you always finish it. And I spent 3 years in a program that wasn't right for me because I didn't know I could say, hey, you know what? This actually isn't working. It is not the right path for me. And then I went into public health, which I do also public health work, but I teach test prep. That doesn't have to do with what I did. And I teach math every single day. So all those years in high school that I said, I'm never going to need this. I don't need geometry. I don't need this.
Right.
Turns out, surprise, I do. I teach it for a living. And so I tell the kids, leave your options open. You never know. And even what seems irrelevant now may actually, you have no idea what your adult life is going to look like.
You have no idea. I skipped biology in high school.
Oh, really?
And all of college. And then I ended up being a biomedical engineer. I was like, well, that is a twist on that, isn't it? So I had to like learn how to heart function, you know, all these crazy things like after I was in my career because I needed it. But I mean, you just learn.
And that's actually an area I discuss with my kids a lot too, is that what feels so deathly important right now, like that the decisions they make at 15 and 16 and 17 are going to determine the rest of their life. That is also not true.
They
often feel like, okay, well, I have to make the perfect decision because it informs the rest of my life. And that's just not true.
And that can add so much stress to you.
You don't know what's going to happen. Even if you think you're going in to be a psychology major and that's what you do, you still may end up as a test prep teacher instead because you just don't know, and things change. And the decisions you make at 15 and 16 are not as life and death as they feel like they are, because at the time, of course it feels like that. And especially if they're looking at colleges and things like that, they've heard from adults, oh, it's the most important decision. And it's not.
Yeah.
And how I feel about college, I want students to go to a college if they want to go to college that's good for them and is a good fit and is the right place and they can get what they need. But the truth is, you can get what you need at most schools. And occasionally there are places that really aren't right for students. That's true. But for the most part, you can be happy pretty much anywhere you want to be at colleges. Yeah. And if you're not, okay, you transfer
and then you go
to a different school.
Yes.
You can change.
Yes.
And that's it. That's all it means is you just make a decision, you go somewhere else and okay, you continue on with life. And nobody's ever told my kids that either. And I didn't know that myself. That's why I was stuck in a program for 3 years I hated and knew wasn't right. It was because I didn't know I could change my mind.
Right.
And as silly as it sounds, I just honestly, I had grown up with, if you start something, you finish it.
Yep. Yeah. And that freedom, that open door, that really can relieve a lot of that anxiety is, you know, it's more of that approach that we're going to try it. And we're going to try it with the best of our abilities because this is the direction we're headed. But it doesn't mean that once you are there that you're stuck with it forever. And so that's a great way to go into a lot of things because a lot of times they're just so young and they just really don't know what they want to do. They're trying things out, and we want to give them as many experiences in their younger years. So they kind of try a lot of things out before it becomes too expensive. But yet there's, you know, teaching our kids that, you know, I always taught my kids we'll try a class out. And if you do the trial class and you decide to sign up, yes, you're going to stay for the semester. Because you paid for it, or you're going to pay me for it. and then once it's done, then you're free to walk away. Just chalk it up as a lesson learned and we'll move on. So question for you on, you know, a lot of times we aren't going to hear that self-talk. Is there any other ways that you parents can notice that there's some anxiety going on? Is there manifestations of other things that we should be looking for?
Absolutely. And especially with younger kids, kids who are maybe 8, 9, 10, older kids can generally identify that they're anxious or that they're feeling anxious. Younger kids don't use the word anxiety. They're not going to come to you and say, I feel anxious.
Right.
And they might even not even know, and they may not know that word or what that feeling is. But where it, how it often manifests for younger kids and for older kids too, but is somatically. And so it manifests as, I have a stomach ache. I don't feel good. I can't sleep. I'm afraid to go to sleep. I'm having nightmares. I can't turn off my, you know, my brain is thinking too much, or my thoughts are too loud. And that those are the types of things that you can be on the lookout for and listen for as a parent, because that is often a tip off of, oh, something's going on where they're not being able to function in a reasonable way. And the first time I encountered this was actually my first year teaching, and I was working with a little boy. He was in fifth grade. So I think he was about 9, and he was preparing for a test. And at the time I went to people's houses. So we were sitting at his dining room table working, and all of a sudden he said, I'm really worried about this test. And he goes, and I'm having a hard time sleeping, and I can't really eat. And I just feel sick. And it was just this whole litany of anxiety symptoms. And he didn't know what he was experiencing because he had never experienced it in that way. Right. And I remember telling him, I said, okay, well, let's put some things in perspective. And he looked at me and he goes, what's perspective? I remember thinking, oh, if you are too young to know what perspective means, you're probably too young to need it. But he did. Yes. He needed some help. And so we talked about all those things that I mentioned earlier about what tests mean, what they don't mean, what it said about him as a person or not, and the place of all of the things. But that I have always remembered that. And I try to really listen for that in my students. And sometimes just things like refusal to do activities or to try new things, or if people start limiting their social activities, if they don't want to leave the house or they don't want to go out with their friends, those can be signs of anxiety as well.
Right. Yeah. That there's the shut doors, the things that the student typically wouldn't do, that makes a lot of sense. And unfortunately the kickback on doing things, a lot of us parents take it personally. I know as a homeschooler, and I've heard this from other homeschoolers too, it's like, why aren't you listening to me? And we forget to turn it around as to why, what's going on with you that would cause this barrier to happen. And so I just want to encourage you parents, you know, as you're listening to Kelly, a lot of times this isn't about you. This is about your child, and really put yourself in their shoes. What is it that's coming in at them that may be causing this change in behavior, that it isn't just defiance. It probably is an anxiety that they're dealing with.
Yeah. Exactly. And if you do feel like it's starting to interfere with their ability to function, I do really recommend getting kids evaluated for all kinds of things, for learning differences, for anxiety disorders, for depression, because sometimes there's really a reluctance to do so. I have a lot of students who come to me, my test prep kids, who they've made it to 10th or 11th grade. And they, a lot of times we start running into stuff where I ask them, have you had an evaluation, have something? And often they'll say no, but I've suspected that I might be dyslexic, or I suspect I might have ADHD. By that age, they know. And so I'll talk to the kids, and then I'll say, do you want me to talk to your parents? And a lot of times they do. And I'll talk to the parents and I'll say, hey, they're concerned something might be going on. I'm noticing some unusual things. It might be worth it to get an evaluation to find out. Right. And sometimes there's, I get different reactions. Sometimes I get resistance, which is understandable. And the reactions that I've had when people are resistant, they're like, well, I don't want to have them labeled. I don't want them to have a crutch. I don't want them to be have a stigma, or I just, you know, things are fine. And the way right. that what I really feel about those things is if there is an issue going on, and this is true with learning differences or with any mental health issues, it's going on whether you name it or not.
Exactly.
And that's by so naming true. It, yes, there's a potential for stigma. That does happen sometimes. That's true. But by naming it, it allows you access to treatments. It allows you to figure out a direction to go. And sometimes it can be really helpful for students too, to just know, oh, I'm not actually broken. I just have this thing going on. Okay.
Right.
And it, because when you don't understand why you're functioning in the way that you do, that's really stressful. And
exactly.
not to use it as a crutch, but if you can say, oh, my brain actually does think differently and I'm never going to perform in this particular way, but I can do it this way. And that way yes. is just as valid as the other way. And so I really highly encourage people to seek outside opinions, because for all those reasons, it just it can be so helpful. And then if there is something going on, you can do something about it. And you've got plenty of options you can do. If you're looking at anxiety, there's counseling available. Some kids do need medication, not most of them, but occasionally they might. Right. There's peer groups that they can do, and individual counseling can help. So there, parent classes can help. There's all kinds of things that can help. Mm-hmm. And if there is something going on, and this is especially true for learning differences as well, if your child is planning to go to college or might enter high school or something, having a paper trail on record is actually very helpful, because if they do need accommodations later on down the road, the information is there. So they're not exactly. just trying to say, if they are going to take the SAT when they're in 11th grade and they need extended time, if they have no history yes. of any documentation, yes. it's really hard to get
really, that. Really hard. Yes.
If
Absolutely.
They go to college and go to the accommodations office and say, hey, I need extra time. I need a reader. I need something. They're going to say, where's your paperwork? And
right.
if you don't have it, it makes it a lot harder. And so
Absolutely.
I really encourage people to step outside if something is going on, figure out what it is, and then figure out how to intervene. And it is okay to look for outside help for your child. So if they do have dyslexia or they do have ADHD, they may need some different assistance than some of your other children. And so teaching Right. a child with dyslexia to read is different than teaching a child who doesn't have it. And even That's I, even true. Though I've worked with kids with dyslexia for years, I have some students who come to me and I say, you know what, I'm not actually formally trained in reading with dyslexia, and this is a level above what I can help with. You really need yes. to be seeing a reading specialist who is trained in this and knows how to help you. And there's no shame in seeking out
right. no.
outside mm-hmm. help.
It's and just different strategies people need for different things. Yeah,
exactly. Yes. So I always want to tell parents, don't be afraid to seek out things, and don't, yes, sometimes there's stigmas about things, but that's part of the way you break stigmas is by,
right.
by talking about them and acknowledging them. And if everybody was comfortable saying, okay, yep, I have this thing or this or my child, whatever, that stigma
right.
would disappear, but it won't disappear until people start talking about it.
Exactly. And I think it's good that we started this whole conversation based on what the child wanted, mm-hmm. you know, because I have left that up to each of my children. What they, if they wanted a diagnosis mm-hmm. or not. And then, you know, I pursued what they felt they needed. Mm-hmm. Because really they're the ones who are going to use that label. They're the
exactly.
ones that are, you know, and if they aren't going to, I mean, what benefit is to me maybe to teach them when they're younger, but if my oldest decided not to be diagnosed, and he had some issues in college and he persevered through them because he was so mm-hmm. pig-headed, he wasn't going to be labeled. So, you know, and more power mm-hmm. to him, I
yeah,
guess.
Which is his prerogative,
yes,
too.
Exactly.
But especially with your younger
but
kids,
when
they're 8 and 9,
exactly.
if they're 15, 16, 17, I really strongly believe in letting kids that age start to have some autonomy about making decisions about their educational careers and their decisions, educational decisions. But if your 8 or 9-year-old is really straight sides of something, intervene early, because life only gets harder. School only gets harder. And
right.
if you don't catch it early, I see my 15 and 16 year olds come to me and they've basically missed 10 years of math because
exactly
they were having trouble understanding it. And it's too late to get caught up when you're you're 15 or 16, but if at you're 9 or 10 and you realize, oh, I have a math disorder or I have a reading disability or difference, yes, then you can do something about it.
Right. And the same, the self-talk doesn't start until after that period too.
Exactly.
And so you're catching it where the child's not thinking it's them, but mm-hmm. there's just something wrong with the instruction and until they hit those teen years and then everything becomes, oh, it's my issue. Mm-hmm. And so
exactly. You know,
saving all of that anxiety as well.
Yeah. And just like difficulties with learning, anxiety issues generally, sometimes they're transient. There are sometimes anxiety disorders that are just specific to a particular event that has happened and then they dissipate. But if your child generally has an anxiety disorder, it's not going to get better on its own. And often kids don't recognize it and they don't know to ask for help or even that they can ask for help.
Right.
And that was something I struggled a lot with anxiety as a child. And I spent years just suffering with it because just like I didn't know I could quit something, I also didn't know I could ask for help. I literally did not know I was allowed to say to an adult, hey, I'm really struggling with this. I need some help. Can you help me?
Right.
And so I really needed somebody else to step in when I was 8 and 9 and 10. And then later as a teenager to say, hey, you're having a hard time here. Let's do something about it.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And that empowers you all the more when you know that you have that ability to say, I need the extra help. You know, I need this accommodation. And I know a lot of parents in our community are they're very proactive about teaching their kids how to advocate for themselves.
That's great. Yes.
And, but even though you're preaching to the choir, I like that you're preaching it because, we need to be reminded that even in the things that, we sometimes feel like, oh, this is a minor issue, your child still needs to know how to advocate for themselves and they need to know what's going on because that anxiety can be so overwhelming and so defeating and carry out even in the longer run. So as far as the strategies that we've talked about, is there any that we haven't hit on that you'd like to really talk about still?
Yeah. So we've really talked a lot about the cognitive piece of it. And there's really, there's three pieces of anxiety. Generally, there's the cognitive pieces. And a lot of that is the self-talk and the what are called cognitive distortions, where you start spiraling into things that aren't necessarily true. A lot of my students will say, oh, well, if I don't do well on this test, then I'm not going to get into a good college, and then I'm not going to get a job, and then I'm going to be homeless, and then I'm going to be on the street. And,
yes.
That is a cognitive distortion. It's not true. And then that's called catastrophizing, where you just spin one thing into another. And then also the negative self-talk and the very black and white thinking of I'm either all good or I'm all bad, or I'm smart or I'm stupid, and being able to intervene on those things. But the other two areas, there's also the emotional part of anxiety, and then there's also the physical part of anxiety as well. And with the physical part, there are a lot of things that people experience as anxiety, and everybody's experience is a little bit different, but some of the common ones are feeling a tightness in the chest or having trouble breathing or sometimes excessively sweating or feeling shaky or just feeling kind of tremulous all the time. And then also, especially for the younger kids, the somatic complaints that we talked about before, like your stomach hurts, you have a headache, you just don't feel good. A lot of times they can't really say what it is. They just don't feel good.
Exactly.
And those symptoms are important to, one, to help kids be aware of, and both so that they recognize them and so that they can intervene on them, because often they're warning signs that something's going to happen. Like if you know, especially if you're prone to panic attacks, say, a lot of times there is a warning signal that a panic attack is going to happen. Your chest tightens, or your fingertips start tingling, or you start breathing a little bit faster, hyperventilating. And when kids know those signs, they can start to recognize them and realize, this is a warning sign that I'm something is ramping up, and I'm about to be in a problem. I'm about to have a panic attack. I'm about to have an anxiety episode, or something uncomfortable is really about to happen. And just knowing that sometimes can be helpful, especially for kids who have panic attacks, because panic attacks, which are very intense anxiety attacks, a lot of times people will hyperventilate. They might lose feeling in their limbs. They feel like they're going to die. They think they're going to die. And those are really frightening. And kids especially don't understand them. And if they feel like they just come out of the blue, and the truth is they don't come out of the blue. There's there's always the warning signs. And if you can start to identify those warning signs, you can de-escalate early. Because if you let things go to a full-blown panic attack, pretty much the only thing to do at that point is just ride it out and until it stops. And they do, panic attacks always stop. Just physiologically, they have to. Your body cannot stay in that state of arousal for very long. And it feels like forever. It feels like you're going to die, but you're not actually going to die. And even if you're breathing too fast, a lot of times people hyperventilate. If you hyperventilate too much, the worst thing that will happen is your body will knock you out. You'll pass out, so that your breathing will be re-regulated.
Kind of do a reset. Yes.
And that's literally the worst thing, but your body will not let you die from a panic attack. Really just understanding what is happening and being able to recognize it, so that at the beginning, because when it's in those beginning stages, there are a lot of strategies that you can tamp down, which I'll talk about it in just a minute. But once you're in that full blown thing, pretty much then you're in it. But once you're in it, you're in it. It's over. And luckily they don't last that long, but when you feel like you're going to die, 5 minutes is a really long time to feel you're about to have a heart attack and you're just not. And so with some of those physical symptoms, when you start feeling those, a lot of it is just general stress management and anxiety management. That's good for all humans and for adults and for kids, but exercise is a really good way to get some of that down. So if you start to feel that, maybe you go and you run down the block and back, or other physical sensations can sometimes override those ones. So I've seen recommendations of holding an ice cube in your hand. The sensation from that is sharp enough and weird enough that sometimes it distracts you from, oh, I'm really anxious, to, oh, my hand is really cold. And, you know, it melts fast enough that you're not going to you don't want to cause any damage to your body, obviously, but an ice cube is there a short enough time that it shouldn't cause any damage to the skin.
Absolutely.
There's also just breathing. Sometimes breathing can help, because a lot of times people will breathe very shallowly when they're anxious. And when you breathe too shallowly, you build up too much carbon dioxide in your system, and then you feel dizzy, and then it freaks you out and makes you more anxious, because now you're like, why am I dizzy? Something's happening. I'm going to die.
Right. Yes.
So deep breathing. There's a method called box breathing. And there's a couple of different versions of it, but basically you inhale for a certain amount of counts, you hold it for a certain amount of counts, and then you exhale. So like I like 5 or 6. So I breathe in for 5, hold it, and then exhale. And that has 2 benefits. One is that it does just physiologically slow down your breathing, but it also gives your brain a second to reset as well, because if you're concentrating on that, you're not concentrating on, I'm about to die from these feelings that I'm having.
Yeah, absolutely. We talked about that in our holistic, if you want to go back, there's a couple of videos. We talked about holistic parent care and the vagus nerve and how to reset that, and with breathing and that, all of that. It's so powerful. Yet when we get into those panic states, it's like the last thing we're thinking about at that moment.
Exactly. And that's why the early intervention is so important, because when you are in a full-blown panic attack and you're hyperventilating, you can't do box breathing. But at the early stages, that is helpful. I really like thought stopping too, which is another technique from cognitive behavioral therapy. And it's just exactly what it sounds like. And it sounds silly, but it's actually pretty effective. And when kids start noticing that they're having disruptive thoughts, or that they're having those cognitive distortions, or they're just starting to panic, is to really just imagine a big stop sign in their head and literally see that sign, and they can actually just tell them stop. Stop, because you get into this hamster wheel of thoughts, that little monkey mind going, and you can interrupt it. And my kids always laugh at me when I say that, but it helps. I use it a lot too.
Yeah.
And that thought interruption throws you out of me. You're like, oh, actually, I can redirect these things. And also knowing that emotions and feelings and sensations are all temporary. They always end. And I do a lot of yoga, and they're always talking about nothing is permanent. And it's true for emotions and feelings too. So even though it feels like you're never going to get out of this state, I think I read a statistic one time, our emotional state changes about every 90 seconds. Things change. And so you just wait a tiny bit, even if it feels awful and it feels like you're going to die, it will shift. It has to.
It will.
Everything shifts and everything ends. And just knowing that too, even though it's something simple to think about, I found that for myself to be really, really helpful. Of okay, this is uncomfortable, but I know because of how the world works and because the experience, this will change. And right. and if I, yeah. I just wait a little bit, the distrust will shift.
Absolutely. And yeah, because we can get into that mindset. It's that, you know, the world's going to end, you know, and all of that. And, but yet that ability to interrupt it, and how powerful of a strategy to teach your child at a younger age, you know, just when they're dealing with these stresses from learning. But in life, we do have some major stresses, and to be able to then use them, you know, maybe when they're taking their driver's test, or, you know, like taking the SAT, ACT, mm-hmm. sometimes, you know, those questions, just, they probably snowball you know, and to just say, no, stop. Just focus on this one. Don't think about mm-hmm. the 20 extra questions you have exactly. yet to answer.
And, yeah. And one of the pushbacks I get about test prep sometimes is people say, oh, well, this is not a skill people need in real life, and you're just teaching to this test, and these aren't real things, and what's the point? But exactly. part of what I am teaching in test yeah. prep is the skills. There are tricks and tips. That's true. But really what I'm working with students on is, how do you make a plan? How do you stick to the plan? How do you get something done? How do you persevere when things are hard? How do you figure out what you want, what your goals are, and how to persevere with things. And those are skills you need in all of life.
Absolutely.
Exactly. So even if your child doesn't take the SAT or the ACT, if they don't go to college or if they take other routes, there are going to be times in their life, driving exam is a good example, or all kinds of stuff when they get jobs, that they're going to need to be able to perform under pressure. And if they right. haven't learned those skills yet, they aren't going to be prepared. And so even with testing, when people say, oh, well, it's only, no, they're learning lots of other things too, which is really right. important to me, that I feel like that's a really important part of the service that I provide.
Yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of times as homeschool parents, and I know I did the same thing too, is I just didn't give tests to my kids for quite a mm-hmm. long time. But I was very careful at a certain age when I knew that we had gotten to a point where this was a skill mm-hmm. And something that we needed to work on for, like the other things that you were talking about, that I put in tests. And I put in tests even that I didn't write, that maybe had wrong answers. Oh. And for them to be able to deal with, you know, not everybody's perfect when they write curriculum, and how exactly. do you deal with that? Mm-hmm. And I remember my daughter coming to me and saying, I was never taught any of these answers to this question, and I just made my best guess. And I was like, well, that's good, because I'm not eventually going to grade you on your right or wrong, but how well you did the test. Mm-hmm. And because,
yeah, and that's part of discernment of being yeah. a successful adult, is being able to say, hey, you know what? I don't think this is right. And being able to say that, that's a skill too.
Exactly. Yes. So true. There's so many other things other than right or wrong answers. Mm-hmm. And so taking that into consideration. So as far as, you know, working with students, you know, what are some stories that do you have any to share as far as, you know, students who just really struggled in this area of this anxiety, and, you know, after having worked with them, what, mm-hmm. where they came to and were able to battle or manage that stress?
Uh-huh. So one of my favorite stories, about 10 years ago, I had a student who came to me. She was in high school and she was going to take the ACT, and she was one of those ones who her siblings had been very successful. They had gone to Vanderbilt. They had walked in and gotten an ACT is out of 36. They'd walked in and gotten a 34 or 35 on the test without really studying. And wow. she came to me, she was scoring about a 23, which is in about the 60th percentile of everybody who takes the test. And she was very much one of those kids who said, what's wrong with me? I feel stupid. Why can't I do this? And she was one who I did actually recommend to get tested. And she, her mom and I talked about it. She went to get tested. She did turn out, she had some dyslexia issues and some attention issues, and she was able to get accommodations for the test. She got extended awesome. Time. And once we started working on it with the extended time, it turned out she didn't have any problems doing the material. The problem was the timing. And once the right. timing was taken care of, she went and took the test. She got a 34 on it, which was incredible. That's the biggest improvement I've ever seen, from a 23 to a 34. And wow. she ended up going to Vanderbilt. And then about a year and a half ago, she called me, and she's now about 25. She has a very successful job, lives in the big city. And she said, I'm going to grad school. Can you help me with the GRE, which is the test I originally started out. So we worked on the GRE. She did really well on it. She applied to business schools. She got into all 12 business schools. She applied to business schools, very competitive. And that was a 10-year journey from I'm dumb and I'm stupid and I'm so demoralized that I don't want to do anything to she's very successful 10 years later. And by then, when we studied for the test, I didn't hear any of the same things that I'd heard 10 years before because she'd had all these years of things that had helped because she had a name and she was able to accommodate in the way that she needed. And sometimes I have parents who are reluctant about accommodations. So I'm glad to hear that a lot of your audience is militant about accommodations because there is sometimes an idea of this is cheating or they don't need it or it's a crutch. And it really honestly isn't. If your child's help them in the ways that they need help. There's nothing being able to work quicker or slower means nothing about your intelligence. So if you need 30 extra minutes to complete your math section, who cares? That says nothing. It isn't cheating. And to me, it's really no different. If your child is having difficulty seeing, you get them glasses. Nobody's going, oh, well, it's a crutch to rely on your glasses.
Right.
It really isn't. So if you need some academic accommodations, who cares?
Yeah.
You know, as long as you're not, you know, there are issues sometimes, especially with tests where people are cheating to get them and whatever, that's gross. Don't do that. But if your child honestly qualifies for them and needs them, use them.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I interviewed a college expert a while ago too. And she said, you can get everything put into place and you don't even have to tell your professor and use it until you feel like you need to use it. So it's kind of like that thing your student can keep in their back pocket. So that when they feel like this challenge is a little bit too much, I really do feel I need those accommodations. They're in place. And like you said before, that diagnosis is done, the paperwork's finished, all that. And you don't have to be scrambling when you need that help. Instead, it's just like this, I've got it and I can do this. And how empowering that is to know that, you know, you've got everything you need to be successful. And isn't that what we want our children to have?
Yeah. And you're exactly right. You still get to choose if you don't want those accommodations or you feel you don't need them or you want to try without them. Great. That is your prerogative to do, but they're there and there's no reason not to take advantage of them if you legitimately need them. And I always feel, and I feel this way about test prep and about life in general, it's better to have something and not need it than to need it and be scrambling last minute. Because I do have a lot of parents and families who come to me and their kid is taking a test in 2 months and it's the last one they can take. And they do think maybe they have ADHD or dyslexia or something, but it's too late to go through the process because that testing process takes a while, it can take months to get it done, to get scheduled and to get in and the appointments and get the report back and get scheduled again. And so starting early for anything, always a good route to go. And then you can make decisions later if you don't need it or don't want it. Fine.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. That's a great point. Cause I think a lot of times people are on the fence and they're like, well, why would I do it? Why would I? So you just answered that question perfectly. So thank you. So I'd love for you to talk a little bit about in-house test prep and what services you offer. And also I want to thank the people at Expert Bookers for introducing me to you for our show. I just wanted to do that shout out to them as well. So tell us about your services and your business.
Sure. So I do provide test prep services. And as I mentioned earlier, mostly SAT and ACT. And then if you are thinking about having your child go to a private school or boarding school eventually later on for middle school or for high school, I teach tests for those as well, because those typically have entrance exams. And then I am also starting a new division of my business that is based on math and really aimed at beefing up algebra skills, because what I'm finding is that, especially in the last couple of years, especially the kids who were in schools, they missed so much math and so many skills. And math is one of those things that also does not get easier as you get older. And I'm seeing that my high school students are coming in without the ability to add and subtract fractions or to multiply decimals. Wow. And those are very basic skills.
Right.
And you can't do higher order math if you don't have the basics.
Exactly.
And so I have a lot of kids who are coming to me and say, oh, I have math anxiety, or I'm bad at math. And it turns out, no, they're not bad at math. They're missing skills.
They're missing the foundational skills. Yeah. Yes.
And the reason that it causes so much anxiety is because, yes, if you're looking at an algebra 2 problem, when you're really at a pre-algebra level, of course that's going to be stressful, and that's going to cause your anxiety. And so I'm putting together a program to really address those basic skills, because especially for the kids who are still in schools, those teachers don't have time to go back and algebra 1. And that's nobody's fault. It's just the reality of the situation. And even with parents who have been homeschooling, I know a lot of people came to homeschooling during that time. And even people who have been longtime homeschoolers, if you were working or job, you know, things just change so dramatically. Everybody has got gaps from all kinds of things.
And absolutely.
So, I'm really wanting to help address that, because math doesn't get easier as you get older, and there's no reason to be anxious about it if you can fix it.
Right. Absolutely. And again, it goes back to those, once you've mastered something and you're good at it, you build on it, but like those gaps are really big after COVID. So I totally get that. I'm excited you're doing that. That's a great, great service that you're adding. 'Cause as you know, the need is great. And, Well, thank you so much, Kelly. This was so informative, and, you had so many great strategies for our families to be able to think about, and, just to be able to evaluate their students and to try some new things with all that, various things that our kids tend to struggle with. And so hopefully you've all taken away a couple things you can try in the coming weeks and months, and also some things you can notice about your student. I think, you know, that's the building block that we started at the very beginning talking about, was, you know, we've got to be more observant, and it isn't just the child and their anxiety problem, but it's something that we as a parent and an educator can come in and walk alongside them with, and encourage them. So that's awesome. So definitely visit Kelly at inhousetestprep.com. That is her website. And if you're listening, you can find that link on the podcast description. Otherwise, if you're watching on YouTube, you can see, I'll get all of Kelly's links to her Facebook and other social media links on that YouTube description too. So you can just click on there and go to her services. So keep up the good work, Kelly. You're doing amazing and helping so many kids. It's encouraging to hear the work that, that you're doing, and just the ways that students are able to be helped by your experience and your heart to serve them. So just appreciate you sharing with our audience some of that enthusiasm.
Great. Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
Absolutely. So next week we are going to continue this this theme of twice exceptional, and executive functioning is just one of those things that kids who have some twice exceptional issues deal with as well. So we're going to talk about at-home methods for developing executive functioning skills. And so you'll definitely want to join us again for that broadcast. But until then, take care, everyone, and God bless. And we'll see you next week, same time, same place. See you then. I want to take just a second to thank the team at Life Audio for their partnership with us on this podcast. If you go to lifeaudio.com, you'll find dozens of other faith-centered podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
This has been Empowering Homeschool Conversations with Peggy Ployer.
Sick of being upsold at gyms?
My guy, you're currently a base member. For $90 more, I can upgrade you to our Shred membership. For $130 more, you'll be a Swole member. And for just $300 more, you'll reach Sweat Platinum.
At Planet Fitness, you'll get energy without the upsell. Never pushy, always free fitness training and equipment for every workout. It's fitness that fits your budget. Join Planet Fitness for just $1 down and $10 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, May 10th. See Home Club for details.